Floor of the House Committee on Transportation. We have three items on our agenda this morning. The first item is the work session on House Bill 3344.
You have to bang that gavel louder. They can't read.
Hello, first session on House Bill 3344. Janet, could you bring us up to date on this?
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of new things at your places this morning. One is a legislative fiscal impact statement, and that's under your agenda. It's not the long sheet. It shows the estimated cost savings from the House Bill 3344. There are not included in the fiscal that's been provided by the Department of Transportation, but part that has been identified by the Legislative Fiscal Office are some costs that are not included in this analysis. Parentheses indicate that there are savings from the proposal, as indicated. But again, what's not included in this, in the cost side of it, are the additional diesel fuel refunds that will be required under the proposal that are in addition to the refund program that's available today for diesel, and the, any enforcement of the diesel fuel buying program. And we can talk about that later when we discuss the bill. But those are, this is new this morning. And another item will be discussed in shortly is the longer sheet provided by the Department of Transportation. So, Mr. Chair, since we have a fiscal impact statement that shows the cost side of the equation for House Bill 3344, but we don't have a revenue impact, which is the other thing that goes along with bills before they pass out of committee generally, and we don't have the cost responsibility analysis yet. We have asked this morning for Dick Yates of the Legislative Revenue Office and Victor Dodier and Mark Marsh from ODOT to give a brief outline of what has been worked on in terms of the revenue impact. And then Dick will also let you know what the Legislative Revenue Office expects to be able to tell about the bill once the model from the consultants and the complete data are available from the consultants to do the cost responsibility analysis. So,
for the benefit of the committee, Representative Lehman has to leave about 10 minutes behind. We have a time certain on House Bill 2986 at 9 o'clock, so we will proceed with the work session 3344 until about a quarter to 9, and then we'll complete the work session one way or another. Thank you, Mr. Yates, for being here. And Dick Yates, ready to come forward for us. Thank you. Or whoever you had to stand, I didn't know.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from ODOT, along with Victor Dodier and Dick Yates from Legislative Revenue. We want to just introduce this subject momentarily here. I think members are aware that we've gone through quite a process in working with AOI, with the OTA, Oregon Trucking Association, and many others to look at the issues around revenue neutrality. And we're going to focus on that today, although can get into other questions if the members wish. The fiscal impact statement that's before you emphasizes the expenditure side and does not get into the revenue side. Nick will get into some reasons for that in the process. What we wanted to get across was that we have worked through revenue neutrality. There are a lot of assumptions in revenue neutrality. And to go through those briefly, I'd like to have Victor do that, and then we'll go through briefly the spreadsheet and try not to overly accountantize you with details and numbers, but at least give you some assumptions.
Good morning, Chair Montgomery, members of the committee. I'm Victor Dodier with the Department of Transportation, and I'm here to serve as a reporter on the process that we at the department and the representatives of the trucking industry went through under the auspices of Associated Oregon Industries to work out all of the numbers associated with the revenue neutrality. And that's one of the three neutrality issues that have been discussed in regard to House Bill 3344. I'd like to talk about the assumptions, which are the text in large enough type that most people can read on the back side of all of the numbers. First and most important assumption is that we're talking about the revenue neutrality at the current law, which assumes the 24 cent current law, 24 cents per gallon of split tax, and the current cost allocation between heavy vehicles and light vehicles. That's 37.7% of cost allocated to heavy trucks and 62.3% of cost allocated to autos and other light vehicles. We made an assumption that the amount of evasion under the weight mile tax system is equivalent to the amount of evasion under the diesel fuel tax system, and essentially didn't try to make estimates one way or the other on evasion. We made an assumption that trucks would be registered exactly as they are today, despite the 11 times higher registration fees that are included in the 3344. We made the assumption that the overall fuel economy of heavy trucks will remain constant over the next 4 years at about 5.53 miles per gallon of diesel fuel. And that number, 5.53, comes from the Oregon report to the International Fuel Tax Agreement. The industry has given credit for the reduction of 106 positions at ODOT, that's salary plus related supplies and services, due to the industry proposal. The department has gone forward with reducing the staffing levels, and so some of that has already been taken into account while maintaining the weight mile tax system, but we've given credit for the full 106 positions in the revenue neutrality calculation. And then the final payments under the weight mile tax system, which are twofold, are credited toward the revenue neutrality. If House Bill 3344 is adopted, there will be payments received under weight mile taxes due for operations in December of 1999 that will actually be received in January of the year 2000. In addition, there are audits that will be done on weight mile tax payments out for 3 years, ending in 2002. And so those payments would also be calculated toward the contribution toward revenue neutrality. And finally, and I think most importantly, the revenue neutrality discussions that we held at AOI were an analysis of the industry proposal. And it's not a detailed, thorough analysis of House Bill 3344 and its amendment. So the numbers that you see here on the backside don't cover some aspects of 3344. And I think the most significant one that I was able to spot was the proposal in the DAX 1 amendment to reduce the truck registration fees for investor-owned utilities. That's kind of in a nutshell the major assumptions that we have taken into account. There are myriad of pieces of data and other things that we have discussed and worked over to come up with this rather large array of numbers which appears on the other side. And if you'd like, I can very quickly walk through some of these things so you know kind of the milestones in here. The top part of the page characterizes the tax payments under the weight mile tax system, and it comes down to a total in the first little block of $255.69 million of taxes received under this total weight mile tax. So that's the target that the industry proposal is shooting toward. We made our calculations of diesel taxes based on heavy vehicle DMT, and that 1.827 billion miles of heavy vehicle DMT are all of the heavy vehicles over, heavy vehicle DMT over 26,000 pounds gross weight. Then we proceed moving down the columns, the calculation of how many gallons of fuel would be consumed to drive that number of miles at the assumed fuel economy rate, and then how much money that would raise in gross fuel tax at 25 cents per gallon. And then there's a 2% discount or offset, diesel fuel tax collections offset that's held by the distributors. So the net fuel tax collections would be the 80 points, or almost $81 million, moving down the column. The proposal, the industry proposal includes number or amounts for fuel or road use assessments for the new registration fee schedule that's included in the Dash 1 amendments, and that would bring in about $53.9 million. The heavy vehicles, the heavy trailer registration fees and the miscellaneous fees and penalties, all those numbers that are calculated there. There are a number of adjustments for different classes of vehicles in the registration fees, and I will point out that there is a difference between the table of numbers that the industry distributed as part of its packet and the numbers that you see here. And when I was preparing this table, Bob Russell and I discussed that, and the reason is basically the difference in calculation, difference in technology, I'll put it that way. I have a series of spreadsheets that are all linked together, and so I can use the calculation of the registration fee increase and all the tables, and Bob doesn't have them linked together. And as a result, when he calculated these adjustments, he was using a slightly different registration fee table than the one that's in your packet and the one that's included in House Bill 3344. So that's the technical reason for the difference. So that amount, those discounts amount to, are calculated out for each of the different classes of trucks based on the provisions in the industry proposal. Then we have differences or adjustments for diesel taxes, diesel fuel taxes. Those are calculated, and I'm about at the middle of the page if your eyes are still holding on.
Do you have a brief question, Representative Hill?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Jumping up to the proposed diesel tax replacement and the 2% diesel fuel tax collection offset, how many people are collecting that tax? In terms of, at the rack is the distributor? Is it the appropriate? I'm just curious in terms of what's the class population there that is collecting that tax for the state?
Chair Montgomery, Representative Hill, I will defer that. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't believe Mike you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll find out and get back to you by the end of the hearing.
Mr. Chair, my question is 2% is 2% appropriate for applying a one sheet of I sold this many gallons of diesel is $1.6 million an appropriate discount for doing that paperwork. If this is distributed amongst 10,000 people, it's a different question.
Thank you.
Let's see. The next item is the administrative cost savings of from the transition. It requires fewer people. That's 106 positions. If those positions, some of which are gone already, but if the 106 positions go, so do the supplies and services that are associated with them. And so we calculated that to be enough to about $5.8 million. Then there are provisions for doubling various permit fees for heavy vehicles, for trailers, for the variance permits. There's an incentive for multiple axles, and then there's actually a tripling of trailer registration fees. And those are all calculated into the revenue neutrality. And then there are some one-time charges here. Revenue items. The when we transition to the diesel tax, there is diesel in tanks in the ground in the distribution system, and there's a one-time inventory tax on that, and that amounts to about $1.8 million, and we've actually split that across the year 2000, year 2001, even though that that tax is due on the implementation of the diesel tax. Because the there is a gain in the amount of diesel fuel tax revenue that you see from the lighter vehicles, those between 8,000 and 26,000 pounds, when we move from the point of collection for diesel taxes to the rack, and that's a credit that is given to the industry in this calculation. There is additional revenue because currently the use fuel tax, which is the equivalent for diesel the gasoline tax, is 24 cents for all those that pay it, the vehicles under 26,000. And we're moving that tax from 24 cents to 25 cents, so there's a little bit of difference there. And then finally, the industry proposal brings in more registration fee money earlier in the process than the current registration fee under the West Mile tax system. And as a result of that, there's a opportunity cost or interest that we gain for receiving that money early. And we've given credit for that in 2 years, 2000 and 2001. And then finally, let's see, there's two things. There's some cash that we would recoup from unclaimed diesel tax refunds. There are a number of entities that would be exempt from the diesel tax, and they would have to apply for a refund of that fuel. We estimated that some of them, a relatively small percentage, would not claim their refund, and so there's a small amount of a credit there. That's $5.6 million. And then finally, the last payment of diesel tax or weight mile taxes, which amounts to about $17.2 million, would be received in January of the year 2000, and that we've taken that number and split it across the 2 years. In all, that brings us to a number which is $256 million, which is slightly over the target for the industry proposal at $255.7 million. That's going back to the top of the page. So you'll see that there's an overage that's calculated in the difference from the weight mile tax system. And then in the year 2000, that's in the year 2000, in the year 2001, there's a slight underage, so we're kind of shooting a little bit over, a little bit under. The industry in the Dash 2 amendments proposes to increase the fuel tax by 4 cents. In calendar 2002, absent any other increases of the legislature. And if that's adopted, then you have the 29-cent diesel taxes used in my calculations in calendar 2002 and 2003, and so those numbers stay relatively close to the target. That's a lot of numbers, and they're very small. And I'm sure that there are a lot of questions, but that concludes my part of this presentation.
There won't be a lot of questions. There may be a few questions.
in calculating the trip permits in terms of, in some of the discussions I've had with proponents of this and how they sell this to intrastate small trucking firms, is this discussion that you don't have to register your vehicle. You would do this by trip permits. How have you calculated in terms of the class of vehicles that exist today, and are we assuming that 99% of them are all going to be registered for the full year, or have you reduced that calculation down, assuming that there will be people who will use trip permits as the methodology in which to reduce the cost of registering their vehicle and only paying for the registration and when they use the vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that goes back to the assumption that we made that the trucks would be registered exactly as they are registered today, so that every truck would be registered in the same weight class and registered for the full year or for the quarter or however they're doing it today. So we were unable to make any any calculations of differences from that.
So, Mr. Chair, just a moment so I get the logic of this. So if that's how they're selling this to small interest rate trucking, then these figures, if that is true and they do follow through, then we would see a reduction in revenue based upon that. If owners of vehicles were to use that methodology to counter the 11% increase in registration fees.
Representative, or Chair Montgomery, Representative Hill, I believe that to be the case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yates.
Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. To quickly run through the sheet that I've given you, what I've done is simply take the numbers that the Oregon Trucking Association presented to you in the booklet that you got. They were dated February 21st, 1999. And basically to agree with the numbers which ODOT has just gone through. I've reorganized them essentially to facilitate talking about them. In the top part of the sheet, you've got the same numbers for current law. That's simply the current law forecast. And then in the section which is labeled House Bill 3344 with the -1 amendment, you've got it organized by tax so that the diesel tax is at the top and then the used fuel tax, which would now not include diesel but propane and natural gas, and the fuel inventory and then registration fees, the weight mile tax and the permits and other things organized together at the bottom. What I wanted to talk about mainly today is you're going to get a different look at these numbers. ODOT and OTA and ALI and the other players in this game have looked at the data that's been available. And I've been waiting and hoping for the model, the highway cost allocation model, to come out of the contractor so that we can use that model to get a different look at the same numbers, essentially. The advantage will be primarily that we can separate it out by weight groups. We can separate it out by vehicle class and look at what's happening within each class, allowing for the calculations within the model of fuel consumption by weight class, fuel consumption by vehicle class, and get a better look overall at how these costs are distributed and how they match up with what will be computed in the model as the cost allocation for each of those groups. So you can get a comparative look at how the revenues paid by different classes of vehicles compare with their cost responsibility. Going through the diesel fuel tax, basically again, the main thing there will be the look. You'll at the different classes, you're going to get different answers from the model, undoubtedly. And then you'll have the problem of comparing, well, what's been done in this analysis is what the model is suggesting and trying to arrive at a reasonable estimate. As an example of the things that the way the model will be different, the calculation of the diesel fuel tax will be based on DMT. So a lot of the refunds that you have here will not appear. In other words, if a concrete mixer is burning a lot of fuel sitting out in front of a job site, that's not logged as vehicle miles of travel. And so in calculating the diesel fuel tax, what we'll get is the tax of the fuel that they're burning while they're moving on the road. So you're going to get a little different look at how these taxes are computed. The job then will be to, you know, in terms of the refund, it really won't matter. You're assuming that whatever they pay, they'll claim that when they're not operating on the road, they'll claim as a refund, or you'll have to evaluate the 15% that's allowed, for example, for log trucks as to whether or not that is approaching what they're actually consuming. The same thing is true with the used fuel tax. We don't have to worry about the reduced evasion part of that in these estimates because we're basing it on DMT. And what the reduced evasion calculation is assuming is the DMT that people are traveling on the roads and not paying tax on the fuel that's being used on the road. And so when we estimate for those vehicles less than
20... Hill has one more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize on the evasion question. If Oregon has a higher registration fee than surrounding states, and assuming in terms of, we believe, the Oregon Trucking Association, there is a high evasion rate today in terms of people who report miles in other states to avoid paying white late miles, why would they not continue that if our registration fees are higher than surrounding states so that they report higher miles in other states to continue to evade Oregon's higher registration fees?
Yeah, I think that you've quoted there as OTA, I believe, is saying that there is evasion, and I think they would say that the evasion exists in the weight mile tax and in fuel taxes, and those are serious questions. But I think they argue that in the international registration program that there is not very much evasion, and that's where your registration fees would be paid, is through the international registration program.
Sure. But it's the same mileage, it's the same information they're recording. So if they're evading Oregon's late miles today, they're not having a disproportionate, they're not reporting for IFTA miles in Oregon today, and then for our purposes, late mile, they're not reporting them, so that would be a disproportionate thing that would be caught in someone's audit. So therefore, I mean, if we're higher than our surrounding states, and they have a practice today of evading Oregon taxes, my question is, by raising registration fees so disproportionate to the other states, does it force those same scofflaws who today are not paying their fair share to continue not to pay their fair share?
The opportunity is there. The only question is their ability to take advantage of that opportunity. Moving on to registration fees, again, the estimates that have been made here is by the group have basically information on what registration is for vehicles that are domiciled in Oregon by weight class, by fee structure classes, and then they have the total amount paid essentially by through proration. And the estimates have been assumed that the distribution is the same. Out of the model, we essentially will get a vehicle count, which is obtained by taking vehicle miles of travel and dividing it by average miles per vehicle in Oregon. Then we have a vehicle count in each registration class multiplied by the fees. Again, we'll get a different look at registration. We'll undoubtedly end up with a different calculation for the amount of registration fees. Preliminary run through there in terms of reductions, I got much higher numbers for the low mileage deduction, where my initial numbers are around $40 million, where the OTA analysis and ODOT analysis are showing about 2.5. Now, part of that is there's a different calculation. The way I did it shifts some of the $14 million in sand and gravel into the low-income, low-mileage category. But basically, we're going to get different numbers out of there, I think. But we still have to do some work on that, and that we have a provision with the contractor that they're going to look specifically at this bill and come back with estimates of the revenue impact of this bill. I guess the only other real comment I have is the problem I have, just to indicate one problem that even using the model is going to present, and that's the road use assessment fee. Current road use assessment fee is based on vehicle miles of travel and applying a fee which is dependent upon actual load. In the bill, the road use assessment fee is per trip. I don't have any idea how to convert miles of travel into number of trips. But we'll work on that, and we'll have the contractor work on that and try to come up with some estimates.
Thank you, Mr. Yates. We appreciate your coming. I appreciate you have one question.
I have one question, and it just occurred to me as you were, thank you, Mr. Chair, as you were talking, Mr. Yates. It was, if my memory serves me correctly, because I haven't gone back through my notes in the paper, so to make sure that this was correct, But hypothetically, then, I guess, is that if evasion occurs today at approximately 30%, wouldn't there be a reasonable expectation that the diesel tax would recover at least 23% more if the evasion under diesel tax is only expected to be somewhere between 5 and 7%? And if that's the case, wouldn't revenue neutrality actually be about 23% higher than what we're currently experiencing?
To respond briefly, you put it in a hypothetical context. I would disagree. You know, the evidence that we have suggests that the evasion under the White Mile Pact is much lower than 30%. The other thing, when you're talking about a fuel tax and reducing evasion, keep in mind that you're switching to a tax structure where most of your money is raised by the registration fee. So it would take a whopping big increase in evasion in the fuel tax to compensate for an evasion level in the weight mile tax. You're not going to get a one-to-one offset, because with the weight mile tax, you're raising $211 million. And with the fuel tax, you're raising somewhere around $100 million. All right, so you've got a factor of 2.5 there in terms of the leverage that a change in invasion. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much. Thank you, all three of you, for coming forward. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us this morning.
Mr. Chairman, could answer one question from earlier. The answer to the question about number of people collecting was less than 20. Give some perspective.
Governor Hill?
Mr. Chair, that then concerns me in terms of a 2% discount on tax dollars for 20 people collecting the dollars. I'm assuming that this is a simple calculation of how many gallons of diesel were sold to filling stations for the purposes of motor fuel. Therefore, a 2% discount, which is $2 million to do it, so that would be about $80,000 per distributor over each year for the purposes of calculating what maybe it should be a simple tax.
Richard Hill is over discussed along that. I'll say something else very briefly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, the way the bill is worded is that 2% is shared with the petroleum industry at all levels in the distribution chain.
Why?
Because all of...
Wait, let's go in the proper direction here. Okay?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, because all of them have some additional expense in collecting the diesel fuel tax. They then report it and pay it to the RAC. So there are thousands of companies that are receiving a portion of that 2%.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Russell. We'll move forward. Thank you, gentlemen. We've had this bill before us for the sixth day, I believe, or the fifth day. We've studied the gas tax 4 or 5 days. This is about the 11th hearing we've had on gas tax, diesel tax, or tax stop committee. The bill has not changed. It's the same bill that was presented to us the day we came in here. We have two proposed amendments before us. One of the amendments, -1 amendments, have been explained to you in detail in our last meeting. The -2 amendments are before us now, and I think they were explained briefly, but before I go to jail, Representative Hill, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I'm just inquiring in terms of the master deal on this. As this balances out with the gas taxes, if the gas tax goes out with a sunset, does this go out with a sunset as well?
Gas tax went out of this committee without a sunset. What happens if it goes out of this committee? I don't even know if it's going to get out of here. But if it does, there'll be no sunset clause on it. If it doesn't, there'll be no sunset clause on it because it's dead. Janet, would you update us on the -2 amendments, or did we get that discussed in total with the committee to feel comfortable with it?
Sure, the -2 amendments add an additional 4 cents in the January 1st, 2002, but that gives the next legislature time to change that.
Is there any discussion with the committee regarding the Bank 2 or the Bank 4 amendments? We are in work session, have been for 45 minutes. Ago.
I'll move the dash 2.
We're going to move the dash 1. I didn't move the dash 1.
No, I'm going to move the dash 1. I'll move the dash 1 then, please.
So we'll do it one at a time. Representative Lehman moves the dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3344. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Hearing none. Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Chairman, I move the dash 2 amendments.
Representative Lehman moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3344. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Hearing none. Dash 2 amendments are in the bill. Okay, now with House Bill 3344 as amended before us, Representative Wells from Mid Hill.
Which way do you want to go? You want to move?
You had your hands up.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3344 as amended without recommendation as to passage to the Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Discussion?
Okay. Hill, we have a motion to move House Bill 3344 to the Revenue Committee as Representative Wells indicated. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just go on the record as this is a pig in a poke. I think it's a bad bill. I don't think it will benefit Oregonians. I think it clearly demonstrates that there's a class shift among truckers. There are significant winners and significant losers in this process. It will have the effect of driving Oregon businesses out of business. It will benefit the common carriers and the interstate trucking business to a greater extent. It will, I think, have a long-term detrimental effect on the ability for Oregon companies to survive. Those will be small companies, companies out in various areas of the state. We have a problem in many areas of the state in terms of unemployment, and this will just simply add to it. I would also add that I also think the bill is unconstitutional. I think in terms of, we'll figure out whether it is or not.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Hill. That's the good thing about democracy. We can all have our opinions. I have mine, and I'm going to read it right now, and then we'll go down the line, and everybody can speak as long as they want to, as long as they don't talk over 10 minutes. Many of the committee members have spent many hours working on this weight mile issue. Representative Wells, Representative Lehman, as well as Janet Atkins, Dylan Robinson, all of you, and many of you, all of you out in the audience, I thank you very much for it. It's been a lot of hard work. In the committee, we've held 5 hearings on 3344, 4 or 5 hearings on 2082, the gas tax. And I thank all of the committee members for their attendance, their work. It's been a lot of stuff that's come before us. Many of you didn't even know what a weight mile was before you came to this building in January. And some of us still don't know what it is, but we're trying to learn. On the weight mile, our charge is to make sure the change from weight mile was revenue neutral and must not significantly shift cost responsibility between light trucks and heavy trucks, or between cars and trucks. That was our job. That was our only job. We've had many reports from many people out here in the audience. They did not all agree, and we must individually make our own decisions on who we believe and who we don't believe, and I'm sure you've all had many thoughts on which way to vote, and probably had many visitors and suggestions on which way to vote. As a committee, we've done all we can do to gather information. We must make our decisions now and move this bill on or leave it right here, whichever comes up at the committee. I'm not completely convinced the criteria has been met, but I'm prepared to vote to send House Bill 3344 to the Revenue Committee for additional hearings and information gathering. I really want to reserve my floor vote until I'm totally comfortable that the Revenue Committee completes their work. It must be revenue neutral, and it must not significantly shift cost responsibility, or a firm no vote on the floor won't change. Yes, Ms. Clark, let's whoever up there later.
Sure, I may leave before the vote occurs, and I will tell you that I would vote to move the bill out of committee. I agree with what much of what Representative Hill says, though. I'm not sure it's unconstitutional, but I respect his legal opinion on that. The concern I have, I probably wouldn't say it with as much vehemence or strong language. The one thing I will say is that the trucking industry and AOI and AAA have done a magnificent job of getting together on the numbers and the Department of Transportation, and I would probably be voting this out of committee as acknowledgement of that effort alone. I'm not convinced it's revenue neutral. I'm not convinced that it does not create a cost shift. And the biggest problem I have is I'm not convinced that what we end up with is going to be better than what we have, and it's the evil you know versus the evil you don't know. And I think that this deserves a serious policy discussion, maybe on the floor of the House eventually, of weighing the high administrative cost of the late mile tax with the high cost responsibility of the late mile tax. It is the most efficient user tax we have in terms of assuming responsibility, but it is also very expensive to collect. I think that may be a good policy discussion. So I would vote to move it, especially with no recommendation to revenue, but I will reserve the right, and right now I would probably be a no vote on the floor.
How many members want to discuss this, say something? If everybody does, I would respectfully ask that if you don't mind, go ahead and vote with Representative Lehman here, and then allow the time after to explain the vote. Is that okay with the committee members?
You can make me vote on this one way or the other. I'm sure
you're a part of it.
You've got to sneak out of here.
That's as long as we have. If there's no further discussion, we're allocating time after we're done with the vote to explain and comment as long as you want. We'll now have the clerk call the roll. Before us is House Bill 3344 as amended to move to the Revenue Committee. And Representative Wells, you keep that motion. Do you have the exact motion? You have it down there, Brad. Everybody understands the motion. All members understand the motion. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
No.
Representative Kirk.
Aye.
Representative Cummer.
Aye.
Representative Weaver.
Aye.
Representative Logan.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Walker.
No.
Representative Wells.
Yes.
Hi.
House Bill 3344 moves to the Revenue Committee. Well, now, if we may start again, thank you, Representative. Have a good speech. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spent several hours on this last night, even by flashlight. Our power went out at 11:30 last night, and I held the flashlight for an additional 2 hours and reviewed notes and reports and testimony. And I really appreciate all the work that everyone put into this proposal, and I just had to come down and decide no. There was one consistent theme from the proponents of the diesel fuel tax, and it was best stated by Troy Likens, manager of Cascade Transfer, when he said, in short, the current system is cumbersome, inefficient, and full of fraud. Proponents feel overwhelmed by the administration of the late mile tax, and they all claim Oregon has a high evasion rate. But that doesn't bear out with the study. The Sowers and Mingle report show that the current late mile tax evasion rate is only 3-7%. Mingle estimates the rate of evasion under the diesel fuel tax proposal would be approximately 12%. Therefore, OTA's proposal showing a shortfall in 2002 cannot be made up through recaptured evasion, which in turn means they would have to increase the diesel fuel tax fee, which we just voted to do, and also increase registration fees. Increasing the diesel fuel tax, I think, is going to be problematical when you have surrounding states that don't have a tax that's the same as Oregon's. In fact, testimony on March 10th indicated that California's diesel fuel tax is 18 cents and Washington is 20. Truckers will simply buzz on through, gas up elsewhere, and registration fees will be left to be bearing the burden of that. I don't believe that cost allocation has been shown. I was very disturbed by the AOI Mark Nelson survey. I felt that survey was tainted because of the communication sent out by the trucking industry to their membership. The Hibbard study was commissioned by a large number of organizations and performed by a well-respected economist, and I think it clearly concluded that the OTA proposal will shift costs within the trucking industry in ways that are inconsistent with cost responsibility by favoring those trucks that carry heavier loads and travel more miles outside of Oregon. Truck registration fees are increasing more than tenfold in this proposal. I heard over and over again from people who came to visit my office, why AAA, why does AAA have a dog in this fight? Well, I think that can best be answered by Keith Snosh of Powell Butte in his letter of 3/28/99, in which he states, "We small independent truckers are the ones who are not represented by lobbies and unions. We still pay our taxes and provide valuable services." And Danette Gross of Dick Gross Equipment wrote, "We are a mom-and-pop business and cannot leave our business to come to Salem to testify." This comment was echoed over and over again. In summary, I'll save the rest of my speech for the floor, but I have to return to the testimony of Mr. Russell himself. I had that testimony, I transcribed it myself, got an audio tape, and upon questioning by Representative Hill said, "I guess what I'm questioning is, in terms of, you're trying to address some inequities and inefficiencies in the cost of administering Wait Mile. Answer, Question, you don't necessarily think Wait Mile is, in and of itself, all things being equal, a bad system, except it costs you a lot of money to administer. Answer, That's a yes in my book. The administration of this tax is burdensome. We heard that testimony. I talked with ODOT about that. I also talked with ODOT about the implementation of this proposal. This proposal cannot be implemented by January 1, 2000. It is clear that it cannot. And it can't be implemented mid-year because of the federal rules from the IRP. So all of those things together have led me to this conclusion, and it was a difficult place to get to. It was the most difficult decision I've been faced with since I've been elected, and I spent hours and hours on this proposal, and I thank everyone for coming to my office and sharing the information with me.
Thank you, Reverend Ball. Reverend Ball.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions that have sort of come up in the last few days since I've been going over the materials that we have been given. And I do thank everyone for their patience and their time and their efforts. First question that comes to my mind is, if evasion and compliance are a problem, why has Wilsonville, which is where I'm from, had such a proliferation of distribution warehouses and trucking companies move in? We have companies such as Schneider and Interstate, G.I. Joe's, Nike, et cetera. We have Rite Aid. We have Hollywood Video. I mean, these are not small companies. Another question that has come up is the $44.1 million that has been purported to be saved or not saved, depending on which piece of paper you read. I guess my question is, does that include the $26.3 million, or is it an addition to it? Which, if it's an addition to it, now all of a sudden we're talking about $72 million. Looking at the registration fees and the effect that that's going to have on the, particularly the small trucker, and I looked at that, and that does bother me. What happens when we add to the gas tax, and if I understood the dash twos correctly, that problem is taken care of. What's the effect that this is going to have on the truck stops? The people that are filling these trucks up, and if they have to collect the tax from the drivers, then what's the effect that they're going to have? What's their cost to administer that, to send the money on to wherever it goes to? I think that one of the things that we have to wonder also is if our diesel tax gets too high, then will the trucks just kind of fly on through Oregon and fill up instead in Washington and Idaho and California? What kind of an effect will that have on our distribution system? I already asked my question about the heavy evasion rate that we're proposing. What I found most interesting, though, is that both sides, both proponents and opponents, chose to have an expert from Nevada come in. And I don't think there's agreement in Nevada as to whether or not it's working or not working. And then I will reserve my floor vote. I voted to go ahead and pass this out of committee. I think that as there's many, many aspects to it, but looking at the dueling studies and the dueling experts and the dueling everything else. But one thing I did tell the trucking industry yesterday, and that is, and I told the opponents yesterday, if this does not do what it says it's going to do and what the trucking industry says it's going to do, I will be the first one to vote to repeal the repeal of the weight mile. And I want that to be understood because I think that it's our duty to make sure that if in fact a system doesn't work, then we need to fix it. Thank you, Mr.
Hill. Devlin. Hill's down there.
Thank you. I'm over here. I'm
bad Holden. Hi, Representative Hill. Good morning.
I'm not going to say another word.
I've just been used to saying your name all morning. Representative Devlin?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be shorter, I think, than the previous party. If our standard of proof was preponderance of the evidence, I think that both proponents and opponents of this change can make very good cases. And it's not clear to me that given different circumstances and different committees, whether the result would have been the same or different, because all the evidence that we have to consider is conflicting evidence. There are times in this building when I clearly think it's correct for a chair to stop a bill from being heard or for a committee to decide that a bill deserves no further consideration. But this decision is of such magnitude and there's been such amount of work on this issue that I think it's important that this full body have a chance to participate in this decision, and I'm going to be following that throughout the process in the House and hopefully on to the Senate. To be honest, I've been a participant or a follower of discussion of debates over weight miles since about 1985, so there's nothing new to me about this issue. I'm a yes vote in committee. I can't speak much longer, I'll lose my voice. But I'm going to look at the issue closely, and I'm not guaranteeing to anyone what my vote will be on the floor. I'll make that decision when the bill comes to the floor.
I just have a short comment. In 1997, my good friend Jerry Overton, who chairs the Transportation Committee in Arizona, worked to repeal the weight mile tax in Arizona. At that time, they had a diesel tax and a weight mile tax of about 6 cents a mile. They had moved in kind of a two-step process. We had Jim Douglas in front of this legislature in 1997 session, or in the interim, can't really remember. He came up. He is works for the Department of Transportation, and led us through their process and what they were attempting to do. When I was in Phoenix in this last November at Multi State Highway Transportation Agreement meeting, Jerry Overton is the chair of that organization of 11 Western states dealing with transportation issues. And Jim was there, and they had a year and a half experience as they had moved. They moved it to the back. Arizona has the highest transportation tax on trucks as Oregon compares, kind of which figures you use, whether they're higher or we are. They have a registration that runs over $3,000. Per year on a heavy truck like ours. Their fuel tax is about 27 cents a gallon, and it's very comparable. And they were very happy to see their revenues were higher than they had projected. They feel their evasion is a lot less, and they are real happy to see what has happened in that state. And so I guess I have to base some of my decisions on what other states have done as they moved away from weight miles, and therefore I'm real happy to see that we're making this move in Oregon.
Thank you. Everybody want to talk down here? And please feel free to talk. Just you need to know we have two more bills. We will hear these bills, and we will go into work session on them today. We have some people who traveled out to Seattle, I believe, and we will show them respect. Thank you. Representative Lopez?
I have one question of Representative Wells about the Arizona situation. What was the impact on the small truck?
We're not getting into debate here, please. But
all right.
Please,
okay. Just wanted that information.
On your vote, but not the gaming.
All right. I can get that information. Thank you. I certainly commend the opponents of this bill, and I've appreciated the information they've brought forth, and it's a difficult decision to make either vote, yes or no, on this. But I believe that this should be advanced to the Revenue Committee, and I am voting yes to do that. I still reserve the opportunity to change that vote if necessary, if additional information comes forth that makes it necessary for me to do that. And I'm looking forward to seeing this new, or the highway cost allocation study and what results that brings out. But I, too, would want the legislature to really follow this, see the results of it if it passes all the way through and if the change is made, and see what the outcome is and if it is good for the people of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I first served in the 1991 session on transportation, I've been impressed with Oregon's, the fairness of Oregon's system. I really did want to support this proposal, though, and I reserve the right to vote yes if it meets. I want there to be a healthy trucking industry. It's the way we get our groceries out where I live in Astoria and all of our supplies. I thought there were compelling arguments on both sides. I was particularly compelled by the argument for simplifying the reporting. I really hope, though, that if this bill doesn't make it all the way through the system, that there can be some technology used by the trucking industry that will simplify that system, and that they might be given some credit for that. I guess I never really bought into the two-thirds of the revenue coming from the registration fee. I had large concerns about that, particularly to the mom-and-pop operations that I see a lot of in rural Oregon. But I appreciate the both sides of this, and
thank you. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. I, too, have wrestled with this issue greatly. I was not up quite as late as Representative Walker. However, I spent most of an afternoon until 10 o'clock last night spraying some of my fields, and this was all that was on my mind. I've been hearing from my local truckers. I've been talking to them. Some of them are my friends personally, people that I use to ship my products with. Some are very much in favor of this proposal, and some are not. Some are ambivalent. And that makes it all the more difficult for me to make a decision on this. I've generally been in favor of this proposal in a conceptual sense for a great while. The testimony has been compelling on both sides. I have friends on both sides of this issue. And ultimately, I told them both that I would make my decision based on what I consider to be sound public policy as a whole, looking at the big picture of the state and where we are today and where we are wanting to go. And ultimately, I believe that it is proper for us to move into this direction for many reasons. I am, however, very concerned about some of the impact this will have on small business people like myself. I do not want to drive anybody out of business. I don't know that this proposal will be fully, if adopted, fully responsible for that, but it may have some substantive impact on some business people, and that concerns me greatly. And if there's one point that has caused me great hesitation, it is that. I, too, want to see further discussion on this issue and further numbers brought forth to give us better information. This is an extraordinarily difficult decision for me to make. Ultimately, I feel that it will be beneficial to the state of Oregon as a whole. I think evasion is substantial, and I'll tell you from personal experience, I've had truckers drive into my place of business, load up, and have never reported their miles. They've told me so. I don't like that. I don't think it's right. I don't think it's fair. I think there are some problems with revenue neutrality to some extent in my mind. I think there are some, without question, some cost shifting occurring here. And I think ultimately we have to weigh all of that against what we think we're going to recapture in terms of evasion, plus the fact that we're eliminating 106 positions from state government and the economies that are saved there. But the other impact it has made in my mind is the impact on business. The fact that I do have friends and customers, people that I do business with who operate trucking fleets, that this is a substantive issue in their mind in terms of the burden of paperwork. And being an entrepreneur and a small businessman, I know the high cost of paperwork that I have to endure. And I think any time that as a matter of public policy that we can reduce that upon business, that is appropriate. So ultimately, I've made a decision to vote this thing to revenue because I want to see continued discussion, continued analysis of this. And I'm going to continue to carry my conversations on with my local truckers before I make a vote on the floor on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I thank the committee again. I thank the audience for letting us express our feelings because we've spent many hours on this and they deserve the opportunity to take a few more minutes and explain where we are and why we're there. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2986. Thank you, Representative Lowe, for waiting for us. Janet, are we ready for that? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. For the benefit of the committee, Brad Daniels has done all of the work on this. He had the honor to get up here and work with the board, and we thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you this morning. House Bill 2986 was filed at the request of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. To give you a little background on this, D&B currently maintains a two-part driving record that consists of employment and non-employment driving records. Employment driving records currently include accidents, suspensions, and convictions that occur during certain restrictive situations, which are listed in your SMS. All other incidents are reported on the non-employment driving record, which is essentially a personal driving record and is important in the determination of insurance rates and eligibility. House Bill 2986 adds to the list of eligible activities during which an accident or conviction can be reflected on a person's employment driving record. We'll call your attention to the Dash 1 amendments that should be at your place, which replace the new provision and restrict the type of employee affected to persons working for a federal, state, and local government, and restrict the type of employment to a public work project involving the repair and maintenance of water, sewer, and road systems. The bill has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brad, and thanks for all your work on it. Just a moment before we do, Representative Shelley Taylor, do you have the time? You're okay. She had to get the hospital, so she can wait. Thank you, Representative Lewis. Thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, Chairman Montgomery and colleagues on the committee. It's nice to see that you are still breathing here now, and this ought to cause you very little heartburn. I know you've been through a lot. My roommate, Representative Walker, I don't think she really went to bed last night. I mean, she was doing on this all night long, but this is an easy one. I brought this at the request of one of my local 350. Basically, let me give you a little fact scenario so that you can sink your teeth into this. You're working for somebody and you're driving a vehicle or you're out on the road in your work capacity. Somebody clobbers you. The accident is not your fault. However, it goes down on your personal driving record. It should go on your work record, not on your driving record. It's a real simple concept. And I would like to introduce to you Ralph Groner, and he's going to tell you a little bit more about the bill, but I do want to thank you very much for surviving the morning and getting to this bill.
Thank you for being here. Good morning, Mr. Groner.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so very much, Representative Lowe. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I may, I'd like to have my president of our Clackamas County Roads Department, Local 350, Don Morgan, and Cynthia Donegan. Would you like to come find me up here and thank me? And also, and I'll introduce him, but I want to hand these out. Mr. Chairman, again, Ralph Groner for AFSCME, Council 75. The issue probably really isn't that simple. Anytime you hear that something's simple as a legislator, I know that you have cause for concern. But relatively speaking to the issue you've worked so hard on, this is. What we have here today are several members of our local, and then we have 125 locals. Of those, we're probably the largest road crew, water works, sewer works union in the state. That's the best way of doing it, in the sense that we have most cities and most counties. One of the problems I continued to hear traveling the state by my locals was it's simply not fair, and I couldn't get my teeth into this for a while, that while we're working, while we're driving a county pickup, and we park the pickup sometimes, we're down in the manhole, somebody hits the pickup, and it ends up on our personal driving record rather than employment-related. You have two choices here. So I thought that this may have been very limited, and I started calling around to other locals and found that in other unions that did the similar kind of work, they've had special meetings about this and concerns. So we thought we'd bring a bill to you so that we could get the discussion going, because we really feel there's some inequities occurring, and I don't think it's intentional. I think that it may be somewhat. I've talked to Kelly, and she's a great person, and it's just that sometimes when these come into DMV, they for some reason aren't coming in employment related. So with some specificity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce our president of Local 350, our Clackamas County Roads Department, Don Morgan, who will go through this with you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try and make this a lot briefer than the previous one. Don't hesitate to ask me questions. I get a little nervous, and my mind's working a little faster than my mouth is, probably. So.
Please be comfortable. You just knew what we had to go through. So you can do
Thank you. The two handouts I've done here that have passed out, the first one, which begins with I've been trying to address the problem, that's basically an outline of the law and the way DMV interprets it now. And the way the DMV interprets it for work-related accidents now, anyone whose job is driving, a principal job is driving a motor vehicle, carrying persons or property for compensation, transporting mail, driving an authorized emergency vehicle, or driving a commercial vehicle, if they are involved in an accident while they're working, it goes on their employment-related driving record. Any other types of vehicles they're driving goes on their regular personal. What happens is DMV doesn't feel that public works, even though they are commercial vehicles, they're large dump trucks, the drivers are using their commercial driver's licenses, they don't feel that our principal duty is driving a motor vehicle. They say your principal duty is fixing the road. And so when the report, if somebody's involved in an accident, it goes on their personal driving record. And in the past, what I've done a time or two, if you make a number of calls, eventually you'll get somebody in DMV who might put it on your employment side, depending on what type of vehicle you're driving. If it's a large enough dump truck. It happened to me once. I was driving a 10-yard dump truck with a 12-foot wide paving machine on it. I was involved in just a small fender bender, but it went on my personal driving record. After it came to my notice, I called DMV, and after the third phone call, I got them to put it on my employment driver's record because I was using my CDL driver's license then at the time. But if I'd have been in a small one-ton pickup, that wouldn't have happened. Basically, then insurance, private insurance, when I go to buy my auto insurance, they look at that and they say you were involved in an accident, and that raises my rates. The second and third page is basically out of the motor vehicle code outlined in the law where they say what we propose. On the second page, I've got it, the definitions, and then they've got A, B, C, and D, which I've highlighted. These are the exemptions. What we'd like to see is another exemption put in that was read for the public workers doing this. The second handout I've given out here, which are actual examples. Now, I'm not as well connected as Ralph is here, so I just, these are actual examples from Clackamas Road Department employees that just over the last 5 years. The first one was a guy, he was a bridge department worker. He was sitting on Highway 213 out between Moala and Oregon City near Molino in a line of traffic, sitting still waiting for a left turn, and a vehicle behind him rear-ended his one-ton truck. The driver of the other vehicle was alcohol and drug impaired and was killed. But on his driver's license, the Clackamas County employee went on his private driver's license that he was involved in a fatal accident. Raised his insurance rate. The second one, another Clackamas County employee, this was a gal on a corner. She ran into him. He actually drove completely off the road, used defensive driving before she hit him. She continued on down the road till her car wouldn't run anymore. Once it wouldn't run, he was down there to see if she got hurt. She gave him her driver's license and ran immediately into the closest tavern. There was a tavern right there, and she went into that. This went on his driving record as a two-car accident, and actually our local safety committee gave him a letter of recommendation for the defensive driving he did, because if he wouldn't have moved off the road, there would have been considerably more damage. And somebody could have gone.
I'd represent Bill has a question for you, I believe.
I'm trying to understand in terms of what's the difference in terms of if I'm in, sitting at a stoplight and a commercial vehicle runs into the rear of me. In terms of, does that go on my personal driving record? In terms of I was involved in an accident. In terms of the fact what class of vehicle it was, should that not then count against me? In terms of, I know the insurance company will come back and say, well, you were involved in an accident. And I understand what you're talking about here, but since I'm trying to understand the relationship in terms of fairness, in terms of, do we not count, because it's a larger policy, in terms of, should we not, you know, since we don't have an assault, so it gets portioned to both. I mean, that's the issue that we're talking about here. And how do we do on the converse of this in terms of if a commercial vehicle is at fault and it runs into the rear of someone who then you could claim, well, I want that on my employment side, not my personal side, because I was driving a commercial vehicle. But the person in front of you who you hit, and you could have been at fault in terms of doing it, they have it on their insurance, and it's going to affect their personal driving insurance, so it's going to have costs to them. How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I think I understand what you're saying, is if I'm driving myself personally, I'm driving a commercial vehicle, and I rear-end you, how am I responsible for it? The way it is handled now, it goes on my employment driving record, and any employer, when I'm going to be applying for a job or anything, they can see that. But my insurance company, when I'm buying private insurance, they would not be able to see that. So I'm gonna find it very difficult to get another job, or if I have a bad driving record, for my employer to not discipline me and possibly fire me.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I understand the issue you're talking about. But in the absence of determining fault, okay, the other person is going to have it on their record. If they are not at fault and they were hit by a commercial vehicle, they don't get a get-out-of-jail-free in terms of their personal insurance. They just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and they will pay a financial cost in their personal insurance, where the driver of the other vehicle will not. And I think this is where we're getting to a very difficult area in terms of fairness for me, in terms of how do we balance this out. And I appreciate what you're talking about in terms of where if you're working your truck's up and you're not in the vehicle and you're down a manhole, I can appreciate that. That is a different circumstance versus if you are on the road and you are driving, just because you are in a commercial vehicle should not therefore give you an out on your personal side. Because if you hit somebody who's not in a commercial vehicle, they pay the price. They don't have the option of saying, well, I want it on my employment side because it was a commercial vehicle that hit me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, again, Ralph Perlner. You, to have that answered, Kelly is here, she can answer that, but also you need to look at the statute, the existing statute, not the amendment. House Bill 2986, if you'll go to page 3, and this, again, I don't want to, again, DMV is here, Representative Hill, but the fact is that if there is fault by, let's say, the truck, the commercial vehicle, my understanding is they can't just go out and drive drunk. They can't crash into you in another truck. There are certain rules and regulations in the statutes now that already handle those kinds of circumstances that you're alluding to.
Representative Loken and then Representative Duffel.
One question.
We will work on this for no more than 10 more minutes. Thank you.
Just one question. I'm not sure perhaps the insurance person would have to answer this, but if an employer has a driver that has an accident, I'm wondering if that wouldn't be reflected in the employer's insurance rate on his vehicle. I don't know if there's anyone who can answer that here.
Pardon me. If they're asking you technical questions you don't know, please, we have DMV with us when they can help you out there as soon as possible. So don't hesitate to say, I don't know. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, John. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Again, to clarify your intention of this, is that if the accident is not charged to the employee by the investigating police officer, then you're asking for an exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krupp, we're asking that it go on the employment driving record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have one more point, Mr. Chairman. On the second and third and fourth pages of this handout, they concern Cindy Donegan, who is sitting here to my left. This is an accident she was involved in 3 years ago, October of 96, when she was working as a temporary employee for the city or for the county. I've kind of outlined the map, what happened. She just placed a work sign. Guy came over the top of a little rise, hit his brakes, panicked, slid into her. She hadn't done anything. This went on her work driving record, or private driving record. At the time, Cindy was a temporary employee making $7.50 an hour, I believe. And I've got an example. The next few pages are of her recent bid or insurance bid. And quotes for insurance, and I just outlined the difference here for what's the difference in her insurance is. It comes to $55 every 6 months, which at the time when she's making $7.50 an hour makes a considerable difference, or a difference to her.
That's fine. You need one to say that to you. Calm me down today. We really appreciate it.
I'm Cynthia Donegan.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, just like Don said, and
just for the record, would you say your name so we have it on tape? Appreciate it.
Cynthia Donegan.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The only thing is that I understood what Representative Hill was saying and everything, and that does seem fair, but the insurance company that I end up paying didn't have to pay for anything, you know, and then I'm giving the money. So that's kind of my deal about it, too.
Thank you very much. We're not looking for something extra special. We're frankly looking for equity in how people are treated.
Thank you. Make sure that you thank you. Kelly, sorry to keep you waiting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Chandler, Department of Transportation. I don't have any prepared handout today. I just wanted to talk to Bill a little bit and just sort of quickly answer a couple of questions that I've heard. The law is very, very specific. Those exemptions that or exceptions or whatever that he was mentioning, those are actually in statute. DMV doesn't have a whole bunch of latitude at all on this other than look at the report and say, does it meet one of these criteria? And if yes, be it a conviction or an accident, with the information we have at hand, that tells us whether or not to code that accident or a ticket as we post it to your record with the words employed. And I certainly can understand what they're saying. I mean, right now, the way the law is, unless I am my job is driving, period. It doesn't go on my employment record. And I think, you know, what they're mentioning, there are those kinds of jobs. I'll be honest with you, we've heard from people in all kinds of occupations that could have this very scenario. One of the women I talked to in the office, her mom is an accountant, but occasionally is required to go pick up clients of her firm at the airport and was in an accident going to the airport. That went on her private record. So there's all kinds of occupations that could be out there on the road for the employer at the time that get in an accident or ticket and it goes on the personal record, not the employment. So I just wanted to mention it. Representative Hill is correct. Oregon has a no-fault law. It would be a pretty expensive administrative thing to try to get into accident reports and diagnosing them and trying to determine who's at fault and who's not. Oregon has chosen to have both parties report, both parties pay type of a thing. They could, if they needed to, maybe get a copy of the accident report, try to submit it as evidence back to their insurance company to show that it maybe they got rear-ended or anything. I don't know how often it happens, probably not real often. I'm judging from the number of accident reports we get requested from just personal people. Representative Loken asked a question about would that then reflect on the employer's insurance rates. And not from the insurance industry, but is my understanding that's the purpose of recording employment, non-employment, both to tell employers who they're employing, so they can check to see what kind of person, and I'm presuming it's because they're going to pay for that person to be driving for them, that's probably included in their insurance rate. So to answer your question, I believe that you're right. And Representative Krupp, I was trying to remember the question you asked, and you were close, but I'm trying to think, not quite
on the mark. Right?
Not quite cigar. but anyway, I just want to tell you, I can understand their frustration. I've heard it from other occupations, but the way the law is, it's very, very specific. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, in the question I asked was in regard to the intent of the legislation, which is very admirable. But we do have no fault insurance, so when a police officer is investigating an accident scene, at some point he assesses some blame to that accident, at least the accident investigations I've been involved in personally. Are those not observed by the insurance companies? My son was in an accident in which a lady turned in front of him and he hit her. And their insurance companies, based on the police report, paid off. And our insurance company wasn't charged at all. So is no fault insurance going to become an issue here? Or are we going to be able to make a determination based on accident reports to achieve this goal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, first of all, police are not at all scenes of all accidents. There are many, 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 I mean, we get hundreds of accident reports in each day, and many of them do not have an associated police accident report with them. And that's why I was saying it is possible for an insurance company to request copies of the report to make a determination themselves, even if there wasn't a police accident report involved, to try to determine themselves to what extent their client was involved. Also, you know, they're getting into that, they're looking at that when they're paying on the accident. You know, because that's how they determine who's going to pay for it. So you're right. They could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, what if a person does not have a CDL license? How is it recorded then on their employment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it would depend on the other pieces of information we have. An officer, when filling out a conviction, because this happens for both convictions and accidents, and on the conviction on the uniform traffic citation form, there is a box for employment-related. And so the officer, when he's writing you the ticket, has assessed whether or not it's employment-related based on those other things. Were you carrying mail at the time? Were you carrying personal property for compensation? Things like that. Delivery truck drivers, things like that. So that's how they help drive that decision. If a ticket comes in not marked employment, and somebody calls us up and asks us to look at it, we'll pull a copy of the ticket off of microfilm and look at it. And if it doesn't have employment related, then we have to get more information. Maybe look at the kind of vehicle they were driving, maybe get a statement from the employer, and look to see if it meets one of those four or five things that are in the statute.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at this, the amendment, the Dashwood Amendment. It would add, I think it would be a very narrow inclusion on the list in terms of public works project.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of just not going to open it up to anyone driving any government-owned vehicle, it would only be public works from and related to repair, maintenance of water sewer road system.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that as a large hole, or is that pretty narrow in your view?
Mr. Chair, Reverend Hill, I think that's a very narrow specific. I think that it's a requirement to have enough information for us to determine that that's where they fall. It would be, again, one of the criteria. You may have other occupations coming to you to add to the list this session or next session. I just want you to be aware that there are other occupations that also have this.
I can see it.
We have legislators. I can think of one statute that every session they add to it with, using employment address versus work address on their driving record, and it's become this huge laundry list in the statute book. So I kind of read it on the list.
First of all, it's wrong what's going on. I totally agree with what they're saying. I hope there's something we can do about it. And they should have no more insurance costs because they just been sitting there on the job.
I understand.
I think you're talking about it. Representative Wells?
I like the bill. Looking at the current statutes and the current principal purpose is the issue. And I think people are involved in public works projects are usually driving marked vehicles, the state or county or whatever vehicles. They're not their own that are driving to the airport to pick up somebody. They are driving public vehicles that are well marked. And I like the bill, and I like to see it moving.
Mm-hmm.
Any other discussion from the committee? Representative Devlin, thank you, Governor.
You're welcome.
Let's get a question for Kelly Taylor.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm just saying I'm eager to go into a look.
Thank you, Representative Devlin. I appreciate it. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2986, and we'll the work session on House Bill 2986. That's banging off the
ground. Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1 Amendment.
Representative Wells moves the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2986. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to say that, one of the most compelling reasons why is the description of the bill that was given to us by Grant. One of the most compelling reasons why I left the bill.
Thank you, committee. You just can't let his first bill go down the plan. I thought this was a slam dunk. The other night we'll have a good record, and now you. pardon me for being too there. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the House Bill 2986 has been amended by the Dangeville Amendment. Representative Wells?
Mr. Chair, I move 2986 as amended to the floor of the D-Pass.
Representative Wells, whose House Bill 2986 is amended to the floor of the D-Pass. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. None. Show the two members absent. Excuse absence. Do we have a volunteer carrier? Representative Hill. Thank you all very much. Thank you for waiting us out. We appreciate you being here.
Representative Lowe, can you
hear
me?
Yeah.
I don't. You okay on Representative Lowe, carrier your own bill, Representative Hill?
Thank you.
Glad to be here. Representative Lowe. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you all very much. We have one other bill before us. House Bill 2583, and we'll wait till we do a little transferring here, but we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2583. I thought Representative Leonard was going to be with us. He's got that as he holds sick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Maybe just a minute, we'll wait till we get Janet up here to explain the bill to us, and then we'll proceed forward. Thank you for listening. Before we get started, would you like to be recorded as a yes vote on the last bill before we take a
vote? Yep.
Whatever we need to do legally to get him in there, it's a yes vote, so we'll do that.
Unanimous consent
to let Representative Cromwell vote on the previous bill, House Bill 2986.
Here we go. Why he wasn't here.
We will have that report later. He can't be in the court. Representative Cromwell, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell votes aye. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis. Could you bring us up to speed on House Bill 2583, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to let you know my heart's beating much faster having to sit down there than having to sit up here. So,
is that harder than me?
It's harder than
me. How much weight do you weigh?
Obviously not enough.
thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2583 would authorize firefighters and volunteer firefighters to solicit donations for charitable programs on or near highways. And you have a dash 2 amendment at your place. And this is Representative Leonard asked for this amendment. And it requires, in order to be able to solicit on or near highway, would require the organization to get a permit from the Department of Transportation, and the Section 2 of the amendment explains that the Department of Transportation would be required to issue such a permit if the organization had adequate liability insurance and a plan for safe solicitation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I have one question here on the dash 2. It's a permit to the firefighter, or is it a permit to the firefighter organization, or the local, why would it be each individual firefighter? Why wouldn't it be to the department?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and we should make that.
We'll ask to be so forward to let the question ask the presenter, so thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for being with us. I don't have your name here, but we've got a sign that she's coming. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters. I'm also a firefighter here in Salem. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee on this good bill, an important bill, not only for the firefighters, but for the kids that we help so much through MDA. I won't read the statement that I have. You have it in front of me. I would just like to do some highlights in regards to this. Last year alone, the International Association of Firefighters, which is our parent group on the national level, was able to raise over $12 million for Muscular Dystrophy Association. What that does is it helps kids that who have been affected with muscular diseases. One of the biggest ways that we raise this money is through the Fill the Boot campaign, where firefighters volunteer their time to on roadways solicit change from passersby. Unfortunately, there is some problems with how that is done right now. This bill will correct that, and as mentioned by the Dash 1 amendments, would correct the problem and allow this to continue. I would just like to mention that the Fill the Boot campaign is really not about money, politics, or even impeding traffic. It's about touching the lives of thousands of kids and being able to make a difference in their lives. In fact, part of the proceeds collected by firefighters go to sending kids to a week-long camp where firefighters volunteer to be one-on-one counselors with these precious and awe-inspiring kids. The firefighters who attend these camps come back rejuvenated and with a sense of satisfaction, even beyond what firefighters experience when assisting people on a daily basis. In closing, I'd just like to mention that this is an important bill to the firefighters and to the kids, that this really helps out. I'd also like to, for the record, mention that Ken Armstrong, who represents the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, is in support of this bill. And I would be remiss, Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind if I just acknowledged not only some of the people from MDA, but some firefighters from Eugene that came up and traveled this distance, not to speak, but just to show support of this bill, and I appreciate them being here. And in regards to the question that you have on the Dash 1 amendment, I'll turn it over to Pat West, and he'll be able to answer.
So before we do, if you know their names for the record, so it shows the record is here, and we'd be honored to have them. You just mentioned their name. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for waiting for this very long time. You can see what our day turns out to be sometimes. But we do thank you for coming, and if you know their names, it would be nice to have them in the record.
Mr. Chair, I don't like to have you have them.
When we get done with this testimony, they can come up and just say their name, and we'll have them in the record.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Pat West. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And
the reason I came up was because the first thing that happened was there was a question as to who would be applying for the permit. Bob touched on it, but it is the actual local firefighters representative or union that would apply for the permit.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is that representing well?
Really didn't, Mr. Chair, as a special issue, remit to a firefighter or a volunteer firefighter.
So if you want to change that so it was your union or something, you wouldn't have each individual firefighter have to get a permit, would you? It's going to be standing on the road? That was the way I would read that stuff that said. So, that's to a firefighter or a volunteer firefighter for solicitation. So if I could read that, that would mean every person that took part in the town of the road would have to have a permit, and I wouldn't think you'd want to do that.
Mr. Chairman, my interpretation of this was that there would be one person that would apply for a permit that would be approved by the ODOT. They would submit their safety plan and how the funds, how the process would evolve, and it would be a single permit for the event, whether it was by the, I spoke incorrectly when I said firefighters union, but the group of firefighters that were getting together to do the fundraising.
Well, we understand what you mean. I agree with Representative Weld. I think it needs another word in there, and that's no big deal. We can do that. We will do that.
Mr. Chair, I want to go ahead and go a little bit more. I guess I'm really questioning why we need a permit. As I would understand, if we allow them to do this, and we're talking about in these small towns, as I understand, the term highway here means a state highway rather than a county highway. You're already doing. I guess another question, you have been doing this. When did this issue come up, so how do you feel you need this legislation?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wells, we have been doing this, but what had happened is that ODOT had asked us to stop because we were actually soliciting on highways, and we didn't have the authority to do that. This bill would give us the authority to actually do what we have done in the past.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the question is, why do you think you need the permit if it's allowed in statute and you want to jump out in those small towns where there's a, as I don't understand, a state highway goes through those small towns and arrange it. Do you think it's necessary that we go through the permitting process with Department of Transportation?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wells, this was a compromise that was reached in a meeting with the ODOT officials. Their concerns were the safety of the event, that no one would end up getting run over, and those type of situations. So by coming up with the process whereby a safety plan would be submitted to ODOT and approved, that is really what the rationale for the permit is, and ODOT agreed to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. As a volunteer fire captain, I appreciate what you're doing and admire it. I think it's very appropriate. I don't think that we should have to have a permit for these guys to be able to do this. That's ridiculous. If there's anybody who knows about safety, it's these guys. They live it every day. Now, I know when I have my week, I mean, these guys are pros. They do this every day. They talk about safety every day, literally. If there's anybody who knows how to stand alongside a road, it's these guys. So I fully support the intent of this legislation. I think it's burdensome and unnecessary to have ODOT require a permit and safety plan. These people are very intelligent and know how to stand alongside a road and not cause accidents or become a problem or get hurt themselves. So I support the bill. I just think it's silly we have to have ODOT require plan approval.
Thank you. I think we've heard your side. We need to have ODOT up here. I think the other item that is here is to make sure they have adequate liability insurance, and if not, maybe the state's responsible, and we're not going to be responsible if you get hit. So maybe that's the issue. If you had your own insurance, let's get ODOT up here, and then we can carry on with your conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Again.
Thank you.
You heard some of our concerns up here, Doug. Can you kind of help us out a little bit?
I hope so. Chair Montgomery, members of the committee. I'm Doug Pimmel, maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. It sounds like
the major question here involves why the permit. I think that what the last couple of statements here were clear, that whatever goes on state highway right-of-way becomes our responsibility, unless there, and so we like to know about it, and we like to be sure that there is insurance, Chair Montgomery, Representative Krupp, some of the people from MDA, actually liked the idea of having to go through and make sure that there was a safety plan so that everybody knew, not so much that we were concerned that these guys weren't going to be safe and didn't know how to be safe, but so that as a team, we could do this the most effective way in terms of keeping traffic moving and making sure that everybody was orchestrated and knowing when they were going to go out and exactly where they were going to be standing or involved in interfacing with traffic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, what are the rules going to look like for this? You got a 10-line bill here. What are the rules going to look like?
Chair Montgomery, Representative Cromwell, as long as the rule, I don't think there will be a rule. I think it'll just be this bill. Anytime there's a parade in a small town, we require a permit. This isn't a burdensome thing. It's not a big administrative deal. Just we want to know what's going to go on out there. We want to make sure there's adequate insurance. We want to make sure we know where the parade's going to go, where the traffic control is going to be. There's no specific rule that covers an extensive safety plan or anything.
Okay. We've got a bunch of hands up. Representative Devlin, and
Representative Wilson. Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder if there are other organizations that you know of that solicit for contributions in this way during intersections in traffic.
Chair Montgomery, Representative Loken, to date, and what's caused this bill to come up, solicitation on state highways is illegal. So
no.
I will not admit to knowing about any that go on.
Okay. I just for sure do think.
I don't actually know of any.
Okay. A little red.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, what's the current status of an employed firefighter going out and standing on a street corner and soliciting donations? Would he not be covered under his department's liability insurance policy already, whether he has a permit or not?
Chair Montgomery, Representative Krupp, first off, it would be illegal under current law to solicit donations. Secondly, the people from risk management made clear that this is a volunteer, this is not part of their job, and therefore not covered under risk. We talked to risk management about that, and they said we have no role in this because it's not part of their job, and therefore they are not covered under their professional insurance.
Thank you, Doug. We have Mr. White here. I'd like to say a few words, too, if he's on our list. Good morning,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I wanted to address quickly three things. The Muscular Dystrophy Association holds $1 million liability policy that covers firefighters throughout the United States. This is a 45-year-old program. In the history of the program, there has never been an incident with a motor vehicle or with a firefighter. Secondly, the reason that we agreed to the amendment of the bill was ODOT asked for it, and we figured if it was the best way to get this through with the permits, we don't have a problem with it, but we agree that it would be much easier, especially on the smaller departments, if it was something we did not have to do. Thank you much for your time.
Thanks for the information. Any other questions? Okay, so.
Are we going to displace any homeless people that are currently begging on corners now?
You don't have to go there, Barbara.
Just kidding. And one last comment, Mr. Chair, if I may, before I vote yes on this great idea, is any of you guys from Eugene know my cousin Steve? All right. Has he made captain yet, by the way?
Hold on, guys. Okay. And thank you very much for being here.
we have the bag's two amendments before us, and the
work session
has made some suggestions. Would you like to comment on these?
Are you in work session, Mr. Chairman?
We will go into work session. So we'll close the public. Is there anyone else who want to testify? I would like to take just a 2 seconds, since these people came all the way to the G, just to get their name on the record, if you wouldn't mind. If you all might come forward and just say your name, and then you can't deny you weren't here. No, that's not. We do appreciate you coming down, and thank you for taking the time.
My name is Steve Fisher, firefighter paramedic, EG Fire EMS.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Ben Walrus. I'm a firefighter paramedic with EG Fire.
Mark Tuchita, I'm with the MDA.
I'm Jeannie Nelson, also with MDA.
Dave Pearson, firefighter paramedic, to Eugene Carr, EMA.
And thank you all for coming, and thank you for the volunteer work you do. We all really appreciate it. Now we'll close the public
comment on
2583 Representative Walker.
I just want to thank the members of my community for coming forward today. Because I am from Eugene, not Springfield.
Anybody here?
Oh, I love Springfield.
Okay, no. We'll open the public hearing. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2583.
Chair.
Representative Jones.
I'd suggest we amend the Dash 2 Amendment conceptually. We'll let the legislative council pick it up if it's appropriate. But have the Department of Transportation issue an event permit to firefighters or volunteer firefighters. So it's a charitable donation runner near. If the firefighters show to the satisfaction of the department that the firefighters had adequate liability insurance for the safety station, so it's more of an event permit, which they could, I guess, assume come together and may be able to get one for the state versus.
Yeah. Okay, the committee, the firefighters understand that we're doing okay. Is there any other discussion?
Well, I have just one question about that. I wasn't listening very well. I'm sorry. I'm so tired. Did you say that it would be issued to the department rather than to individual firefighters?
It would be, Mr. Chair, my intention would be that it would be, they could go in and combine for an event permit, or if they wanted to come in and get their own, it's good, but they could collectively come and get an event permit for the plan that they could show their ODOT, so it could reduce how many people have to show up to ODOT.
Mr. Chairman, I would say it'd be best that we leave that determination up to ODOT, because it'd be better if it's issued, if it's a municipal organization, if it's issued to their, well, if it's a local firefighters group or a local, that would be issued to that. If it's issued to the firefighting department, then you've got another party that's involved. Two separate.
Is that understandable when you're...
I don't think it's inconsistent with what Representative Devlin said. I'm just referring, I'm not saying who gets it, it's just an event permit that is for firefighters, volunteer firefighters.
Event covers it. And Doug, you understand? Okay, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you say an event permit, are we still talking about a permit that will say that you can solicit charitable donations on or near a highway?
That language is all there. We're just adding the words "an event" before on line 7 before permit, and then just changing the plural on the firefighters.
I will speak to that, if I may, Mr. Chair. I have no problem with soliciting donations. I've done a lot of fundraising myself, but I think on or near a highway bothers me. If we're on or near a shopping center or something like that, I have a problem with soliciting in traffic. I will have to be a no on
this. Okay, that's any other discussion? We have before us the Dash 2 amendments, conceptually amended, and we have the first call roll.
Representative Hill. Aye.
We have the Dash 2 amendments, conceptual amendments, as discussed by Representative Hill to House Bill 2583. We have before us now House Bill 2583 as amended.
Move to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves House Bill 2583 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, I'd just like to state that my brother's a firefighter, so I think they're very warm and fuzzy, and I love what they do, and I'm glad we have this bill. I think it's a great idea.
That's on the record. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I want to make clear that I totally support MSD and what they're doing and the firefighters. And if they want to send me a solicitation envelope, I'll be happy to send
them. Record. The Representative Wilson loves the firefighters, too. And, but at this point, are you a no, Representative Wilson?
Yes, I am.
Let the record show that Representative Loken is a no.
Mr. Chair,
Maven is a
C. I declare a conflict of interest on the firefighter.
Well, I thank God it's 10 o'clock. House Bill 20, what number was it? 4583 is amended, goes to the floor with a due path recommendation. Representative Loken voted no. Maybe we can have Representative, well, this would be wonderful. Representative Cup and Representative Leonard, joint chair.
Mr. Chair, I would be honored. The only question is he going to request I wear leather?
You're going to wear your firefighter.
Mr. Chair, before we go.